The journalist Eric Weiner says he can't think on a bus. It's impossible for whatever reason. They remind him of being a kid going to school or camp, and these were places he didn't really want to go. So it's hard to concentrate. But a train, that's different. Weiner loves riding trains. It's where he did a lot of the work on his new book, a book about philosophy.
I tend to see the world through place. And I really deeply believe that where you are affects who you are. The thing about being on a train is that you're really neither here nor there. You're in transit, and yet you're in a real place. Moving along across time and space, your little world is that little train compartment. And there's something actually about the combination of the coziness and the expansiveness of a train compartment that I just love. There was one moment I was going across the U.S. from Washington, D.C. to Portland, Oregon. And I decided to go to the observation car. And I got there and I saw this Mennonite guy, maybe early 30s, had a big beard, and he was just looking out the window at nothing in particular. He just had such a peaceful look in his eyes, and he just seemed so at ease with himself and where he was. And I just realized how little, until that moment, how little in my life I've experienced that. There's definitely something about trains and contemplation that go together well. Wittgenstein, the Austrian philosopher, called philosophy the slow cure. And he suggested that instead of greeting each other with have a nice day or some other empty expression, that we say have a slow day or slow down, take your time. And I think there's something to that. There's a kind of mustiness to both trains and philosophy, but also something charming and something really useful. They both demand that we slow down. I think all philosophy begins with a pause, stopping, slowing down. The reason I travel by train in the book is for those experiences, to slow down, to be reflective, and to just experience.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Eric Weiner knows people think about trains the same way they think about philosophy. Both once may have been this vital part of the world, but now they're mostly reduced to quaint anachronisms. Not much you can do about changing the fortunes of train travel, but philosophy? Weiner thinks he can still make philosophy useful for people, even in a digital world where information is easy to find. Wisdom is not. And there's a difference between knowledge and wisdom. Weiner's new book is called The Socrates Express, In Search of Life Lessons from Dead Philosophers. Let's talk about your own search for wisdom, because you confess in the book this lifelong sense of melancholy, which you've tried to deal with, you say, throughout your life, religion and books, even psychedelics. But nothing offered you more than just a kind of temporary fix until, and there's this story you tell, one Saturday morning, you found yourself in the basement.
Yeah, and that's where I keep my books that I don't want the public to see. You know, when you have guests over for dinner, when we used to have guests over for dinner, you've got the books out there on display in the living room that are acceptable. And then you've got the basement books. You know, you've got The Gas We Pass, Personal Finance for Dummies, how to Lose 15 Pounds in 15 Seconds, you know. And it's where I found The Story of Philosophy by Will Durant, which fell into the musty book category. Dates back to, I think, 1926, and it literally emitted a cloud of dust when I opened it. But I started reading, and I kept reading, and not for the usual reason that, you know, this is some how-to book that's making me feel like I can change my life and lose those 15 pounds, etc. But here was a man. Durant was a historian mainly, but he was a good writer, and he was passionate about this subject of philosophy. And it got me thinking about it as sort of the missing link in my life. Because, I mean, we're all hungry for wisdom, right? And especially now, I mean, with everything that's going on. And what are the typical sources? Well, we've got religion. That's where a lot of people turn to for wisdom. And for many people, it's extremely gratifying. For some people, it is less gratifying, or it's suspect, or it's got too much baggage from our childhood attached for whatever reason. Yeah. So another source is science. And science is great when it comes to information, pretty darn good when it comes to knowledge. Not so good, I think, when it comes to wisdom. Not that it's bad at it. It's just being asked to play a role that I think it's not intended for. Science is not going to help you resolve ethical issues or tell you how to lead a good, proper life, those sorts of questions. And that's where philosophy comes in. And it's not new. It's been around for many thousands of years. I sort of stumbled into it and spent many years sort of excavating philosophy.
You say Durant was a man in love with wisdom. That sense of love must have been striking.
Well,
that's
what the word means. Philosophy comes from the ancient Greek philosophos, which means, you know, one who loves wisdom, and it interestingly doesn't say one who is wise, right? Any more than the Declaration of Independence in our country says anything about obtaining happiness. It's the pursuit of it. So it's actually the act of loving wisdom that makes you a philosopher, as far as the ancient Greeks were concerned. So it conveyed a certain passion that I had never associated with philosophy. I always thought it was a dry subject, one that was not particularly practical. There's even this notion that philosophy, studying it, can be dangerous. So I don't know if you know this, but the comedian Steve Martin majored in philosophy in college, and he said during one of his stand-up routines, he said, if you major in any other subject in college, you know, just physics or English literature, you forget it the day you graduate. It's all gone, you know. But if you major in philosophy, you retain just enough to mess you up for the rest of your life.
Right.
He used more colorful language.
Yeah.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
Is that it's just going to sort of, not only is it impractical, but it's going to confuse you and you're not going to be able to sort of get through the day. And I guess I sort of had that impression of philosophy too, but I discovered that while partly it's true, there's a whole nother side of philosophy, which is passionate, which is practical, which is useful to times like these that we find ourselves in.
Well, it is times like these, I guess, that I wanted to talk about and use that as at least part of the filter for what we say. And not just being about this, because I think there are a lot of elements, a lot of lessons in the book that go beyond just this moment. The idea of wonder, for example, which we'll get to. But let's talk about the moment we're in and the questions that it's raising, because you've been writing about how this is a time of, this is how you put it, questions without answers. Explain what you mean by that. What's your insight
there? Well, we want to know. We have basic questions like, when will this be over?
Yeah.
When will we have a vaccine? When can my kids return to school? Is it safe for them to go to school? That's just the beginning of it. And so the experts can provide us with incomplete answers to these questions. They certainly can't answer the big question of when this will be over. And so we feel unmoored and adrift and awash in uncertainty.
And how do we humans feel about uncertainty?
Not so good.
Not so good.
I'm going to draw a distinction here in that the difference between uncertainty, though, and our tolerance for it.
Yeah.
Uncertainty makes everyone a little bit uneasy, But it turns out some people are much better at tolerating uncertainty than others. So it's not like a physical wound or something where everyone's sort of going to react more or less the same way to an assault in your body. It's a fuzzier concept, uncertainty. Some people in some cultures are actually better at tolerating it. Hmm. So we're living in uncertain times, but that need not be catastrophic for us mentally and emotionally. And that's where philosophy and science sort of join hands and agree on that. You know, there are lots of interesting studies that show that in the right conditions, in the right degree, a little bit of uncertainty can actually make us happier. And that some people do seem to have this higher tolerance for dealing with uncertainty. And, you know, it's nice to have these recent studies, but as someone who studied the philosophy, I know that you go back 2,300 years, more or less, to, say, the ancient Stoics, and you'll find that they're talking about exactly the same thing.
Yeah. I want to get more to the Stoics, and because one of the lessons that you talk about in the book is how to cope. But you mentioned the importance of increasing our tolerance for uncertainty. Give us a sense of what was going on for the Stoics as they start thinking about this. Because I have to say these ideas of Stoicism, this came at a time of uncertainty for the Greeks. I mean, you mentioned Athens had lost a lot of its independence, that Alexander the Great had died. So there's this question about who's going to be in power. The old order was gone, you say.
Right.
So that was a lot of uncertainty there.
Yes. So, you know, we tend to like to say that we're living in unprecedented times. And we're not really. We're living in unprecedented times for our own life. But as far as human history is concerned, we've been through much worse than this. This is not new. Many philosophers lived during times of pandemics, much worse than the one we're experiencing in wars, famine, etc. And that was true, as you say, of the Stoics. It was an uncertain time politically and personally for people in Athens. And along comes this man named Zeno in 301 BC, and he's pacing underneath the colonnade or stoa in Athens, which is where the word Stoic comes from, based on the architecture. I just want to say that he's not lecturing, right?
Yeah.
He's holding basically jam sessions. People are coming. It's not a classroom. Picture like the middle of a shopping mall in Salt Lake City or a crowded marketplace, and all of a sudden someone just, you know, grabs a corner and says, let's talk about the meaning of life. That's what philosophy was like back then.
Yeah.
It had real soul to it.
Yeah. You really engaged and dug in this.
You dug in, and it wasn't removed from life. It was right there in the marketplace, in the agora, and it wasn't like off in the ivory tower where it is now.
Yeah.
And so Zeno's pacing, and he's talking, and people are gathering around, and he basically develops this theory that that is summed up in these simple words that some things are up to us and some things aren't. Okay.
Yeah.
Very simple. Like it seems incredibly obvious. But in fact, we, especially today, tend to go through life thinking that an awful lot is up to us, right? And if we're not rich, it's because we're not trying hard enough. If we're not healthy, we're not exercising enough. And the Stoics put the line way off on the other side that most of what happens in our life is not up to us, except our internal reactions to those events. And they thought that was huge. That was something we really could control that most people don't bother controlling. They focus on the outward and not the inward.
Yeah. Our tolerance for all of this, there's a good illustration, I think, of it. You mentioned in your writing from the movie Lawrence of Arabia.
Right.
You want to take us through that?
So they're in an encampment somewhere in the Middle East, and Macho Lawrence takes a match to light his cigarette, and he snuffs it out between his thumb and his index finger. Just snuffs it out, the flame and all. And this younger officer is there and saying, "My God, I mean, how do you do that?" And Lawrence says, "Well, there's a trick to it." So the younger officer lights a match and puts it out between his fingers and yells, "Ouch, that hurts." And Lawrence is like, "Yeah, of course it hurts." And the officer says, "So what's the trick?" And Lawrence says, "The trick is not minding it hurts." And that's stoicism in a way. In fact, it very much is stoicism that yes, it physically hurts. These things are painful for a second, but you don't need to dwell on them. And in fact, you can short circuit the pain by not dwelling on it. And so we go through life, stub our toe, and we're stuck in traffic. And some people, if they're stuck in traffic, ruins their whole day. They raise their blood pressure. They go crazy, bang the steering wheel. Other people listen to NPR in the car, and they're not fazed at all. And the Stoics would say the person who's chilling out in the car is actually correct, and the person who is overreacting is actually incorrect. I mean, empirically wrong. Yeah. They've made a wrong interpretation of events.
You write this about that Lawrence of Arabia story. You said, sure, he felt the pain, yet it remained a sensation, a reflex. It never metastasized into panic. Lawrence didn't mind the pain in the literal sense of the word. He didn't allow his mind to dwell on and amplify what his body had felt. So, yes, there was something physiological going on, but he just didn't dwell on it. That's stoicism, I guess.
Yes, he didn't accede to it, assent to it. That's the term they use. And this happens like automatically to most of us during the day, that we get some bad news and we're upset and we think that we had no control. We had to be upset. It's more clear when it's a physical pain and you stub your toe and you let it ruin your whole day. But we can have sort of emotional pains or mental pains, you know, little disappointments. And we think that our negative reaction, our dwelling is automatic. And again, getting back to the pause, the Stoics say, no, pause, sever the link between the action and your reaction. And you actually have control over that. So in a way, it's a very empowering philosophy because it says that when it comes to outward events, we're less powerful than we think, way less powerful. But when it comes to our reactions, we're actually a lot more powerful than we think.
I want to shift from the Stoics, but before we leave the idea of uncertainty, the embracing uncertainty, I want to say something about your writing, how creativity and science, you know, artists and scientists and writers, if they embrace uncertainty, it can really help cultivate this idea of creativity. And you mentioned Keats, for example, the poet, called it a negative capability.
Meaning that the artist, the scientist also has to be willing to dwell in uncertainty for at least a while.
Yeah.
You don't want to spend your whole life there. But you have to be willing to tolerate it for a while to get somewhere new. If you are always intent on being certain about everything all the time, you are unlikely to lead a creative life.
Eric Weiner, his book is The Socrates Express, In Search of Life Lessons from Dead Philosophers. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER connects you to your community and brings you the facts about what's happening across our state. As part of our service-driven mission, we value your input. What issues should our reporters be covering where you live? Whose stories should we be telling? Do you have a question about a program or a story you heard on the station? By answering a few short questions, you can help us improve our statewide service. Consider leaving your feedback at KUER.org/feedback.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The former NPR foreign correspondent Eric Weiner is our guest today. And he's gotten us thinking about philosophy, you know, the ancient wisdom expressed by eccentric thinkers. Because Weiner thinks it could be useful right now as a way to cope in the time of a pandemic and how to react when the trees in the park by your house were all toppled by a frightening storm, or just as a way to figure out what should matter in your life. His book is The Socrates Express, In Search of Life Lessons from Dead Philosophers. Somebody described philosophy as life-enhancing poetry. You mentioned that in the book. I really like that idea. I never thought of philosophy in those terms.
I think that's a great phrase because we tend to think of philosophy as something analytical or something whose goal is truth. And then we find that you put it up against science and it falls short, even though science was once a part of philosophy, but never mind that. Yes. If you're looking for truth, you're probably going to choose science over philosophy. But if you think of philosophy as life-enhancing poetry, then all of a sudden it takes on a different meaning, and it's sort of valuable in a different sense. It's valuable the way, say, reading a good novel is. When you read a novel and you put it down, the world looks differently for a while afterwards. You know, you see things differently. And with, I think philosophy can play that role too, but hopefully that feeling stays, that renewed, fresh perspective actually stays longer than just a few days.
Yeah. Let's talk about what you were trying to do with the book itself, the way you mm-hmm. sort of put it together and how you went about this. First, mention the philosophers that you chose. I mean, you had a lot to choose from. You narrowed it down to 14. So why these?
Well, they spoke to me. they were people who, in the case of Nietzsche, they shouted at me.
Right,
But they spoke to me. It was a personal curation in that sense. If you Google philosopher, you'll get hundreds, probably thousands of possibilities. Yeah. But I chose ones who seemed like real people, not some saintly figure up in a pedestal.
Yeah.
I didn't realize this till afterward, but pretty much none of them were attached to a university in their life. And if they were attached, they didn't stay attached for very long. So these were feral philosophers. These were free thinkers. These were kind of wounded souls with some kind of strange habits, I have to say. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the Swiss philosopher, had the habit of exposing his backside in public on more than one occasion. Schopenhauer, the German philosopher, would talk to his poodle in public. So these were strange men and women, but they owned their strangeness. There was something heroic about them. And, I wanted a cross-section. We think of philosophy, we think of Western philosophy almost mm-hmm. exclusively, but the West has no monopoly on wisdom, of course. So we've got Confucius in there and Gandhi and a fairly obscure Japanese writer, a woman named Sei Shonagon.
Yeah.
And I wanted sort of a cross-section across time, too. So the book takes you everywhere from Socrates and 5th century BC Athens up to Simone de Beauvoir, who didn't pass away until 1985.
Yeah. I want to get to as many as we can. Let's start with Socrates because he's the perfect example of someone who did not exist on a pedestal or shouldn't anyway. I mean, although people do put him there, you say, he right. wasn't, you say in the book, just an idea. He was this is how you put it, a breathing, walking, nose-picking, joke-telling man. And he was known to be ugly. He was a fairly rough character. He must have smelled awful.
Right? He tended to wear the same thing that – he actually slept on a blanket and then just threw the blanket on him during the day as his clothing, which even back then in his time was considered odd. Yeah. And he always walked around barefoot. They had sandals back then. He didn't need to do that. So he was an odd dude. And he was annoying. He'd go up to people, imagine you're eating a sandwich for lunch in some cafe and some guy comes up to you and says, "What are you doing?" And you're like, "I'm eating a sandwich." "What's a sandwich?" It's two pieces of bread with stuff in the middle. "Well, what about that? Is that a sandwich? Or do you really know what a sandwich is? And why are you eating it?" And he would just go on and on.
No, but that's literally what he did, right?
I mean, that's literally what he did. Yes. Usually not about sandwiches.
But he was relentless in his questioning of people.
Right. He was relentless the way a five-year-old is relentless with the why questions.
Yeah.
"Can we have ice cream for dinner?" "No." "Why?" "Because it's dessert." "Why?" "Because it's not good for you." "Why?" It just goes on and on. And we get annoyed at some point with the child. But we get annoyed not because their questions are silly, but because we really don't have a good answer to all their questions. Eventually, we get stumped. And Socrates was the same way. But instead of wrestling with ice cream or sandwiches, he was wrestling with the questions of what is courage, what is beauty, what is love. And in the dialogues, which are, have been called enlightened kibitzing, which I quite like. That's what's going on. Socrates is buttonholing these generals and poets in Athens and asking them, so you're a general, you must know a lot about courage. Oh, yes, I do. And then what? Let's talk about it. And, you know, so in the beginning of the conversation, the general is absolutely sure he knows what courage is. Yeah. By the end of the conversation, not only does he not know what courage is, he's not sure who he is and where he is, and his head is spinning. And for Socrates, that was the beginning of philosophy.
You say that Socrates wasn't really interested in some of the questions about the nature of the universe, for example. I mean, he was interested in something else. He let others deal with, you know, why the universe worked this way, how the natural order was.
Which up until that point, that is what philosophers – he wasn't the first philosophers. The ones who came before were ones mainly interested in those questions, like what is the nature of reality and why is there something rather than nothing? But Socrates was really the first philosopher to bring philosophy down from the heavens and put it squarely in people's homes and to focus on the how questions. Because I think that was ultimately his goal. How can we be happier? How can we lead more meaningful lives? How can we be more just? And you know, this is the practical part of philosophy that sadly has been lost over the centuries. And now we've got self-help books and Oprah and all these other ways to fill that void. But, you know, one goal of my book is to help resurrect that original meaning of philosophy, that love of wisdom and that medicine for the soul, the ancient Greeks used to call it.
The lesson that you mentioned for Socrates in particular, although there may be many, is one of them anyway, is how to wonder. Say something about that, if you would, because this is one of the things that you mention in the book, that philosophy is not in the head necessarily, or just in the head anyway. It has a heart. And you tease out this sentence from a man named Jacob Needleman, who said, our culture has generally tended to solve its problems without experience its questions.
Right.
What's he saying there?
I see. I was as perplexed as you were at first, and I thought, you know, how do we experience a question? We ask a question, we might answer a question, and, you know, can we experience a question? And I came to the conclusion that we can and that we don't do it often enough. To experience a question means to sit with it the way Socrates did, and to not always reach for that answer. You know, we live in a fast food society, and we live in a fast answer society as well. We're always looking for the quick answer. And we reward that behavior. You know, if you're at a meeting and the boss asks a question, how do we do XYZ? And someone pipes up with an answer right away, even if it's the wrong answer to a different question, they're sort of like, they look smart. Socrates thought, in fact, they were quite ignorant, but they weren't aware of their ignorance. So Socrates' big thing was actually a celebration of ignorance. So after he goes around Athens asking people all these questions, he realizes that he, Socrates, may be the wisest man in Athens, as it had been declared by the Oracle at Delphi, because he said, at least I know what I don't know. And that, getting back to wonder, that's what wonder is about. It's knowing what you don't know and then going from there. You don't stop with that. But we often don't even get to that starting point because we're so quick to find an answer that we don't sit with the question. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. So let's apply what you've learned about Socrates for people, because you get into the question that a lot of us ask ourselves about our lives and, you know, and our work. Am I a success? And here's a sentence I found kind of startling in the book. You wrote this, Socrates was a failure.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, he died and he was executed and for asking annoying questions, essentially. That was probably the real reason. He did not the conversations, the dialogues often ended in an impasse. They don't always, you know, get to the end discovering, oh, we've nailed down what courage is now or what beauty is or something like that. So the dialogues, these conversations often end in a stalemate or no satisfying conclusion. And he is executed for corrupting the youth of Athens and impiety, but really it was asking a lot of annoying questions. And you know, I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek in that he's successful and that we're talking about him 2,500 years later, but he didn't write a single word, didn't leave us with a body of knowledge. There's no pharmacology based on Socrates. There's no technology that is based on his ideas. He left us with a method, with a how and not a what. And actually, I think that's pretty darn valuable. More valuable than knowledge, because knowledge is perishable, and we don't want ancient Greek pharmacology for the most part.
Right.
But the how, the Socratic method, that's just as applicable today as it was in his time.
Let's talk about Schopenhauer. He was a decided pessimist, but what seemed to distinguish him was what you call this philosophical edifice that he constructed. I think you say that the metaphysics of misery.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that, because
all philosophers are pretty grumpy people.
Yeah.
It seems to come with the territory.
Right.
Schopenhauer was probably grumpier than most, but he also developed this whole metaphysics of misery, this philosophy of pessimism, where he, and we don't have time to get into all of it, but essentially he described the way the world operates and described it as the worst of all possible worlds.
Yeah. Now, you write about feeling that dark shadow over you. And so I'm wondering, what is it that's useful about that? Because the lesson you take from Schopenhauer is how to listen.
Right. Well, so he was a world-class grump and a philosopher of pessimism with some redeeming qualities.
Yeah.
One is he loved animals. He wasn't able to express it to humans, but he had his pet poodle that he loved.
Yep.
And he also was an early connoisseur, if I can use that word, of Eastern religions and Eastern philosophy at a time. We're talking 19th century, where it wasn't like you walked into the bookstore and there was, you know, Buddhism and Hinduism books. I mean, this was all new, and he saw the wisdom in it. And he also loved music.
Yeah.
And he played the flute every day at noon, Rossini. And people have questioned whether he really was such a grump, if he could play the flute like that and could appreciate music. So he basically thought that while the world's miserable, we can escape it for a while, escape this misery through the arts, and in particular music, that it allows us to escape this negativity.
I want to ask you about that, because you say that for Schopenhauer, like, I'm just thinking about people who are trying to cope and deal with this moment, turning to art, which doesn't seem useful in some ways, but this is what Schopenhauer thought. He said people could break through art, through music, they could break free of their own ego. It took away what he described as the mist. So the lesson from Schopenhauer for listeners out there trying to make sense of the moment is what? Is listen, find music, find art, find an aesthetic moment is how
right,
I put it,
right? So that you – look, we're going through a tough time. We all need a break from it. And that's not an indulgence.
Yeah.
That's a necessity and a reminder of the beauty that still exists in the world. The world is no less beautiful now than it was 6 months ago. I mean, a rose is no less beautiful. Rossini is no less beautiful to listen to. But we're not attuned to it anymore. And Schopenhauer would say, stop and listen. And he also was an early advocate for listening to yourself. And he warned against social media, even though social media didn't exist yet in his day, but books did. And he always warned people, you have to put down your books and listen to your own thoughts. And I'm sure if he were alive today, he would see everyone logging on to Facebook and Twitter and getting this fire hose of other people's thoughts of ideas coming at them and say, whoa, you know, what do you think? What is your still small voice saying? So he hated noise. He wrote a whole essay against noise. And he, even though he loved books, he also knew the value in putting them down and, as we'd say today, logging off for a while.
Yeah. Simone de Beauvoir, I wanted to ask about her. This isn't a chapter about how to grow old. That's the lesson you extract there. And this didn't come easy for her. I mean, at first she feared growing old like we all do, but she came to this, you say, quiet acceptance about getting old and even a sense of joy about it all. Talk
right.
about Simone.
And I think anyone who knows anything about Simone de Beauvoir would be shocked that her chapter is called, you know, How to Grow Old.
Yeah.
Because she went fighting and screaming into old age, as you say, and
yep.
she wrote this, you know, even though she's best known as a feminist writer, she wrote this large tome called The Coming of Age, which is 80% negative in
right.
a Schopenhauerian way about
yeah.
how, you know, old age is terrible. It's
yeah.
the worst thing. And but yet, if you sort of like look between the negativity, you see these glimmers of light. And then she came around to a feeling of acceptance. And I'll be honest, I extrapolated that. But I think if she were around and she were to read the chapter, she'd agree with me.
I think so too. I like it. I like you say there's no way she would create a top 10 ways to grow old, but you sort of make some for her based on, of course, the way she was thinking. And, you know, among them, let's see, own your past, which I really liked, make friends. But I wanted to ask you about one in particular, stop caring what others think. This is something you quote Beauvoir here. She said, by a curious paradox, it's often at the very moment that the aged man, having become old, has doubts about the value of his entire work that he carries to its highest point of perfection. Talk a little bit about that. Just
right.
the idea of, again, this is an assessment that a lot of us make about how successful are we, how good are we at what we do, and a lot of the times we're really afflicted with this idea of what other people think.
Right, and we will go through our entire life basing our self-appraisal of ourselves on what others think,
yeah.
on the accolades and the awards. And then at a certain point, when we're older, says Beauvoir, we're liberated. We no longer care. And then we can look back at what we've created, this mountain we've built, and decide to go climb another mountain
yeah.
that we really don't want to go any higher in this one. So we are – old age can be liberating is what she's saying. And I think she's right about that. And ideally, we don't wait until we're old to be liberated. I mean, you or me or anyone listening to this could be liberated this second from caring what others think. You know, in fact, all the philosophers I write about, not just Beauvoir, would agree with that. The Stoics would agree with that. It's our reactions. It's up to us. But we end up, you know, spending so much of our life chasing mirages, and it's only toward the very end of our lives that we see them for what they are, just illusions.
Hmm. Say something about Sei Shonagon. I didn't know much about her. Yeah, but
Sei Shonagon. Now, that's good. I'm hoping if you knew about every one of these philosophers, and I would not have chosen them well. Sei Shonagon was a courtier in Imperial Japan, in Kyoto, which was the capital of Japan, back in the 11th century. It's about 1000 AD. And she wrote this curious little book called The Pillow Book, which is really a bunch of lists. Now, I love lists. I'm a list person. I've like made 6 lists today, and I include things like write to-do list will be like something on my list. So
right.
I like lists.
yeah.
And her book is all these lists, but it's very opinionated, like it's very contemporary that way. It's like things she loves, things that are infuriating, things that are like, oh my God, I can't even, you know, and it's all there in great detail. And she's got this sharp eye, but also this appreciation for the small, for the beauty of the small. And I tend to be the opposite. I'm a big picture, big idea, big sandwich kind of guy. And she's seeing the beauty in the cherry blossoms, in a bowl of strawberries, and the way a kimono lies this way, or in smells. She had a very sharp nose for, and back then they had, it was called a cult of beauty at the time, which I think is a great kind of cult. And they would appreciate aromas, and they'd have like scent-offs and competitions where people would concoct different incenses, and then judges would determine who made the one that smells the best. So it was a very sensual and sensory place and time, and she epitomizes that Schrödinger was a philosophy of things, of material things, and that can form the basis for philosophy too.
Yeah. You know, the cherry blossom comes up in something else that you wrote about that we were talking about earlier, philosophers trying to get us to deal with, not just tolerate uncertainty, but celebrate uncertainty. And you write about the Japanese philosopher Yoshito Kenko, a Buddhist monk,
right,
who said the most precious thing in life, in fact, is uncertainty. And the cherry blossom comes up as a way to illustrate that.
Yes, that, as it's been said, beauty lies in life's vanishing. Mm. That the cherry blossom is beautiful, not despite the fact that it only blossoms for a few days, maybe a week, but because of that fact. And that's why it's worth celebrating. And not just because, oh, it's here and then it's gone and we have to appreciate it while it's here, but there's something actually beautiful about its transience, its impermanence. It is a fundamentally different way of looking at uncertainty and impermanence that, to be honest, I've not yet fully grasped, but I just sort of know intuitively that the Japanese are onto something with this. And I wish I could fully get there, but Schrödinger took me at least halfway there.
Yeah. Let's talk about Montaigne finally.
Because good, you say, old Montaigne.
Good old, yes. Montaigne. You say he speaks more loudly and clear to you as almost any others. Why?
Yeah.
Why is
that? I like him. I liked him. I mean, he's the philosopher I'd most want to have a beer with, as I say, or probably a glass of wine, because he had a vineyard in his estate there, his house.
Yeah.
I mean, he was where he came. He's writing in 16th century France, in the south of France. He's got a pretty good life. You know, he was mayor of Bordeaux for a while, and then he went to escape the plague, actually, a pandemic, and he goes off to his family estate, and there's a tower there, and he climbs up the tower, and he's about my age, actually, and he's like, I'm gonna sit and really think about what matters. He had about 1,000 books in there and views of the countryside, and that's about where I am, you know. Done a lot with my life, been a foreign correspondent. I'm trying to think what really matters. What are the big things and what are the small things? And that's what Montaigne set down to do, but he doesn't do it in an arrogant way. I mean, he's very learned. He was reading Latin at age 5, which was unusual even for that time. And he's a smart guy, but his motto that he actually had emblazoned like on a coat of arms was, "What do I know?"
Yeah.
That's not, by the way, a good campaign slogan.
Right.
Well, for me, what do I know?
Yeah,
what do I know? Right. But actually, it's something that I think most any serious philosopher would embrace Montaigne's slogan, "What do I know?" And by that he means, do I really know this to be true? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can sort of say, well, I think it's this and this and this, but what do I know? And that action of saying, but what do I know, brings you back to that place of humility. And then you go off and you try to build on that, but then you're always tearing it down and saying, but what do I know? And also, Montaigne was personal. I mean, he wrote his essays. He invented the genre of essays, you know. And he writes about everything. He writes about thumbs and cannibals and flatulence and wine and war and famine and life and death. And he writes about it at first not so personally. You know, he's quoting a lot of other philosophers. But as he goes on, you can just see him getting more comfortable in his own skin and writing more personally and saying, you know, this is how I feel about it. Never mind what Seneca said. This is what I think. And, you know, and I was a journalist for many years and spent a lot of time quoting other people. And I feel like Montaigne, I'm sort of getting more comfortable in my own skin and saying, you know, this is how I feel about things.
But the lesson of Montaigne is how to die. And at least in the book. And you say for him, Montaigne wrote about how to confront death, how to fully, just frontally face it, full on, and to rid it of its strangeness. But this was something you mentioned that you struggled with. You this is how you put it in the book. You said you wanted to come to terms with death, but still keep it at a safe distance. And of course, all of us do. We don't want – I mean, you know – and this gets at this really intriguing part of the book, this section with Montaigne, is that Montaigne is basically saying we should – and he has this experience where he actually can do this. I want you to talk about rehearse our own death in a way.
Yeah. Well, he was not certainly in love with the idea of death any more than you and I are at first. And he wrestled with it. And then one day he had an experience where he's riding his horse. He was actually a very good equestrian. He loved horseback riding. And some idiot, kind of like on the highway, in a big truck, essentially a big horse, plows him over, knocks him over. Montaigne goes flying head over heels off the horse, lands with a thud, and he's out. He's coughing up blood. He's not moving. He thinks this is the end. He's dead. And he has what I guess today we'd call a near-death experience. And it's very peaceful, and it's kind of a slipping away. And, of course, he doesn't die. He comes back. But that experience changed his whole perception of death from something that was unnatural and to be avoided at all costs to something that is perfectly natural and therefore must be accepted and can be accepted. I mean, he says in so many words, nature's got your back. Don't worry about this.
You know, I've been thinking a lot about that point, especially right now, because we here in Salt Lake City and other cities along the Wasatch Front in Utah are cleaning up from this really destructive windstorm, you know, hurricane-force wind. And it made me think about that idea of Montaigne, what he was saying about nature, you know, trying to say, look, yeah, I get it. It's sort of – this is a natural process, but it was also so destructive and people are just mourning all of these trees, these big grand trees that are now down and people are cleaning them up as we speak. What do you make of that conflict between accepting nature and also saying, no, this is – I can't accept this idea that this was somehow
right.
Natural.
No, I wrestle with it, to be honest, because, you know, this notion that if it's natural, it must be good, that's hard to accept. The fires we're seeing raging out west, not that far from you, that's, well, natural and unnatural both. Can we accept that? But there have been plenty of earthquakes and hurricanes through the ages that predate climate change, that were natural, but can we accept that? And it kind of comes back to Montaigne's what do I know? You know, it's sort of like, well, it doesn't look good, that earthquake or that hurricane, but what do I know? It's a certain baseline of humility that can be liberating, I think, especially when it comes to death. I mean, really, all you can do is say, what do I know except that death is natural and I'm a part of nature? And that's where Montaigne ends up, I think. And I don't think it's a bad place.
You know, I'm starting to see as I go into the foothills and hike, I'm starting to see the leaves turning. And it made me think about something you mentioned. Montaigne said how he came to approach death not as a catastrophe but something beautiful. He compared it to the falling of a leaf in the fall.
Right. And the leaf may not want to fall, and we may find greater beauty during the summer when there's all this greenery. But we also see the beauty in autumn. And we don't act like, oh no, it's autumn, the leaves are falling, this is terrible, right? Because we know, we have the perspective to know that there, you know, there will come winter, yes, but there will come spring and summer again. And so what Montaigne is saying to us essentially is, well, what do we know? maybe there is a bigger picture. And, you know, part of his philosophy and all philosophy is, I think, a kind of radical acceptance that we're not going to know everything. And that doesn't sit with us very well. We want to know everything, and we want to know it right away. But what philosophy teaches us is to accept our limited knowledge, to celebrate what we do now, to celebrate what we do know, and in a way to celebrate what we don't know. that there's a lot we don't know, and to be fully conscious of that and to say, hey, that's okay.
Eric Weiner, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Doug. I enjoyed our enlightened kibitzing.
Eric Weiner, his book is The Socrates Express, In Search of Life Lessons from Dead Philosophers. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, and we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Thanks to our new intern, Ivana Martinez. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.